Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Joe Biden has appointed an ethnically diverse and, for the first time, all-female communications team to speak for his administration when he takes office in January. And who speaks for the president matters. We're looking back at previous administrations and what we've learned over time about the role of a communications team. Annie Linsky is a national political reporter for The Washington Post covering the 2020 presidential campaign. Welcome to the show, Annie. I'm sorry, I cannot hear. Are you there, Annie?
Yeah.
Okay,
hi there.
Great. Hi, Annie. Jennifer Psaki will be Biden's White House press secretary. What do we know about why her and the team at large?
Well, you know, like you said, it's an all female team. Psaki is going to be the spokesperson for the campaign, so she'll for the White House. So she'll be at the podium, and that's a significant thing. It means that she'll be the face of this administration. But you know, the layer right below her, and there's some contention about this, also includes several Black women who will also be in the sort of a position that's often sort of like a training ground for the next person to take the podium. So that is Simone Sanders is going to be the spokesperson for Vice President Harris. And then this kind of long title, which nobody ever completely uses, but first deputy press secretary is also going to be a woman who is African American, and she's going to be, you know, so she's also going to, at times, this is a job that at times will also do these press briefings, which, you know, before the Trump administration that big of a deal. They were just sort of like, you know, super fans would watch them on C-SPAN. But now after the Trump administration, they have become sort of even a higher profile position. And so that woman, Karine Jean-Pierre, is somebody that Americans are going to begin to see, and she will be, you know, sort of phased into everyone's living room. So it is a very different type of team. And also just, you know, covering Washington, you often do find that even as, you know, women have made great strides in many, many industries, you know, in the media, you will still frequently see a lot of stories that are just dominated by male voices, where you look at the story and every single person quoted is a man. And you know, in talking to some of the senior Biden, you know, allies about this move, it was in their minds that, you know, for most stories about Joe Biden, there's going to be a woman quoted. So,
and that's news. It's interesting. And, you know, you made the point that the Trump administration raised the level of awareness about this role because of the way they conducted themselves, particularly during these press briefings. What were they like before?
Oh, in sort of the Obama
era? In the olden days, yeah.
So my favorite Obama, I covered the Obama White House, and my favorite story about them is I was working for Bloomberg News, which is very exact on numbers, as everybody should be. But, you know, you have people who are trading kind of instant to instant.
It's a business type. Yeah, right.
Yeah. So, and I was listening to Josh Earnest giving a briefing, and he said that there will be new sanctions that will be levied on some country. I can't remember what. And he said it's going to be a $10 million sanctions. And I remember thinking, gosh, I think that's wrong. It can't be $10 million. Like, that's nothing. And then we had several people also listening at the same time back in the office. And so I emailed the National Security Council, the spokesperson to the National Security Council, and said, look, we heard 10 million. I think you meant 10 billion. And within, you know, 20 minutes, somebody went to the podium, passed Josh Earnest a piece of paper. He opened the piece of paper and didn't repeat his error, but just said, there's been some confusion about an earlier statement I made. The sanctions against whichever state are, you know, $10 billion. And I say that to just to mention the Obama people wanted to be exactly right in the communications that they gave to the press. That doesn't mean they weren't spinning at times. It doesn't mean that they were not putting the best light on what they were saying. But in terms of the facts, they felt like it was part of their job to have a sort of a precision level to where, as sort of a junior reporter asking kind of a mundane question that's never going to make a headline, they were able to correct it within 20 minutes in real time. That did not happen with the Trump administration.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Washington Post national political reporter Annie Linsky. We're talking about the role of the press team for a president. And we're looking back and we're going to be looking forward during the show today. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The AP's Jennifer Lovin, we're going to have her on the show later on. She covered the George W. Bush and the Obama White House for the Associated Press. And she said that past press secretaries used to claim a tug in two directions. This is what she told NPR. The need to put out the clearest message and the best spin for their presidents, and the need to get information out to the public through the media. And that's what really feels different about, and I am one of those dorks that used to watch, you know, on C-SPAN and whatnot, the press conferences, the press briefings. What that seems to me the biggest change of all is it seems there's only tug in one direction for the Trump press office, and that is to put him in the best light and get out his message, not necessarily to inform the public.
Issue that has been much different in the Trump era and media relations is that with the Trump administration, President Trump is very much, and throughout his 4 years, has very much served sort of as his own communications director and his own press secretary, and is sort of this avid consumer of TV news and has very strong opinions about, you know, how he's being portrayed in sort of a moment-to-moment way. And other presidents have, of course, been quite interested in how they're being portrayed, have been very angry at the media at times, have had combative relationships with the media. None of that is new, but the previous presidents have not taken on the role of, you know, being their own spokesperson. There's always been more of a buffer there. And in some ways, that means that you've had more access to the president of the United States and his thinking than in previous White Houses. But it also means there has not been sort of an alignment between the message coming out of the White House and sort of the agenda that the president is trying to drive. And in many cases, this president, President Trump, his own communications have undercut what he's trying to achieve on the Hill and elsewhere. And that's the kind of discipline that you are not likely to see from a Biden administration. And what's interesting is I think Biden himself does have some of the same instincts to sort of answer questions directly, to go off message, to say things that get himself in trouble with his press shop. But it's starting with this sort of plan. You know, there is a plan, and sometimes Joe Biden kind of goes veering off of it. And that does sort of make things interesting. And you can see there are different people at different minds at work. It's not just sort of like, covering a big corporation or something along those lines. But Biden does have this structure in place that Trump kind of just rammed through and disregarded.
Do you think there's going to be any carryover in the relationship with Trump between the Trump administration and the press corps into this next generation, into this next administration? I guess I'm asking that because things change. I mean, Biden will not take office in a vacuum. It's going to be changed. And also, people are going to watch it more closely than they ever have. So he may do things just like they always did in the olden days, but it isn't the olden days anymore.
I think that's a great question. And that's one we've been really kind of wrestling with, to what extent has the relationship between the media and the White House kind of irrevocably changed? The Biden team is trying to, especially with the press team that they unveiled, which are people who have good relations with the media, they are trying to signal this return. But it's really hard once that mold has been completely broken to go back to it. And you do see Biden having some of the same instincts of, you know, he does get very angry at the media. He doesn't like it when people ask him questions out of turn. He gets frustrated and he kind of displays that in a very open way, in at times somewhat combative way. I mean, at times in a more jokey, you know, it depends on his sort of mood in the moment, but it is hard to see it completely returning to complete, like, you know, C-SPAN boringness. That being said, I mean, you know, Jen Psaki, who's going to be his you know, spokesperson. I mean, she is really well known as being a professional, as being helpful to reporters, but also on the record saying a lot of words and saying absolutely nothing with those words.
In the tradition of the best press secretaries.
Yeah. So, you know, you're kind of expecting these press briefings to, you know, if I ask, you know, a three-part question, Jen Psaki's response is likely going to be, well, you know, for the first part of that question, I will refer you to the Department of Treasury. And the second part of that question, I'd like to refer to HHS. And the third, we'll go to DOD. Next question. So this is sort of the temperature lowering that we can kind of expect. So, you know, in some ways, I do think, and I think with Trump, the press does need to not take the president at his word. And I think to the extent that there are some reporters and some outlets who are becoming a bit, you know, lazy in that regard in the Obama administration, they learn very quickly not to. And I think that is a good lesson and one that needs to sort of, that kind of rigor needs to remain in the Biden administration, that, you know, when they say something, it's not stenography that we are being paid to do at the White House. And I think that it would be appropriate for us to continue to use that, you know, a very high level of scrutiny, you know, with Biden, and not assume that his people, because they say they want to be more fact-based, are really going to be more fact-based.
What about who's in the room? That seemed to change during the Trump era as well. There's this the existence of the so-called floaters, people just floating it, you know, people who float around who don't have permanent seating assignments. And there's the tradition of, like, the big shot reporters looking down on them and blah, blah, blah. But during the Trump era, people out of nowhere were appearing from all different kinds of organization, media organizations that a lot of people had never even heard of.
Yeah, I think it appears, at least so far, that the Biden administration and Biden transition and the campaign has worked within the framework of the White House Correspondents Association guidelines.
Which were the traditions. It was a tradition.
Right. It was a tradition.
Yeah.
That's right. And so, and that those guidelines do limit the, they do put limits on who has a seat in the briefing room, who has access, in part, you know, who has workspace in the White House. You know, it doesn't mean that a president can't, like, make a phone call or to a different reporter or invite a reporter in for an interview or, prevent his cabinet officials or his top aides from talking to reporters who are not part of this group. Mm-hmm. But the White House Correspondents Association has, you know, long controlled that space. That fell apart a bit under the Trump administration. I mean, I would expect it returns to that type of, you know, that guidance does get followed, just because the people who are involved with Biden's team are kind of longtime, you know, understanders of those norms. But that being said, I mean, Joe Biden does not like a lot of these pool and these restrictions that the White House Correspondents Association does put on him. He doesn't like a lot of the rule. He doesn't like the idea of a protective pool that follows him around. I think, sort of understandably so. I mean, Obama chafed under some of those sort of norms. So I don't know that, you know, I don't know that it will be exactly the same as it was prior to Trump. I do, you know, we are really looking for the Biden people to look at ways in which they can, you know, change that model a little bit. And I'm sure your listeners know there's the way that the press covers the president is to have what we call a protective pool. And it's, I think it's actually 13 outlets. I mean, it sometimes changes, but you have 13 slots and reporters kind of rotate in and out into those slots and follow the president and the president-elect everywhere he goes for everything he does. And so for the individual, it means that, you know, Joe Biden, if he wants to take a bike ride on a Sunday in Rehoboth, before he can do, he can't just get out of his house and get on the bike. He has to tell his staff and they gather the protective pool and they come in a van and then they follow him around. And so it does become a little limiting in terms of your personal freedom. Obama famously would chafe at this and they would say like the bear is on the loose. Like, he left the White House.
Yeah, there's some pretty memorable walks he took, followed yes. by the press corps. It was kind of interesting. Well, Annie, I really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
That's Annie Linsky. She is a national political reporter for The Washington Post, covering the 2020 elections in transition. Coming up, we are going to hear from other reporters and Tom Jones, a senior media writer for the Poynter Institute, and more, and a historian. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher.
In the sense, when I say Rocky Start, I mean it in the sense of Rocky the movie, because I came out here to punch you in the face. And also, I don't talk so good.
That's Melissa McCarthy playing the character of former Trump spokesperson Sean Spicer on Saturday Night Live. In her characterization, McCarthy zeroed in on the combative relationship between Trump White House press team and the press corps. And although she exaggerated Spicer for the sake of comedy, it's been hard to exaggerate the relationship between the White House press corps and the White House press office. Jennifer Lovin covered the White House during the George W. Bush administration. She was chief White House correspondent for the Associated Press at the beginning of the Obama administration. She also is a former president of the White House Correspondents Association. Welcome to the show, Jennifer Lovin.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And Tom Jones, senior media writer for Poynter Institute for Media Studies. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
And another Jennifer, just to confuse everything, Jennifer Mercia teaches history at Texas A&M University. She's the author of the 2020 book, Demagogue for President, The Rhetorical Genius of Donald Trump. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Jennifer Mercia, you've written multiple books on how presidents communicate with the press and the nation. Has there ever before, at least in modern times, been the likes of Donald Trump to contend with?
No. Okay. Definitely not. You know, I think that his rhetoric has befuddled scholars of presidential rhetoric. And I think it's more accurate to think of him as a demagogue. He communicates like a demagogue. And I think it makes a lot more sense to think of him in that frame than to think of him as a president.
There were presidents, though, that didn't mind. I mean, in a way, he had a very close relationship with the press in a way that a lot of presidents don't. He had no trouble right to their face trash talking them. And then at the same time, you know, there were presidents in the way past that would be more closer with press than not.
Oh, sure. Trump loves to work the press. He works them in private. He works them over in public, right? He breaks the frame in terms of what we would expect between the relationship between the press and the president. So he's constantly berating them, you know, telling them their questions are stupid. You know, this is why they don't trust you because you ask me these terrible questions, things like that, you know, that really break what we think of as the spectacle of the press interview.
Now, Jennifer Lovin, the trash talk in the press by presidential people, candidates or whatnot, is not new per se. I remember covering national campaigns when Dan Quayle was on the ticket with George H.W. And he would do that. We'd be sitting up in the dais and or whatever in the pen, and it would make the audience turn around and start booing us and that kind of thing. And that was 20, 30 years ago. It's not new, right?
No, it really isn't. I mean, look, I think there are a lot of things that are new, but it's important to pull the thread of what's different and what isn't. The rhetoric and the breaking of norms that everybody has so rightly focused on that President Trump has used, frankly, across the entirety of his presidency, not just in his relationship with the press, right, is as I said, it's rightly a focus. But absolutely zero presidents have liked their press corps. And every single one has used whatever tool existed in that, you know, time to go around them, right? So, you know, we often think of, you know, you sort of attach the personality of the president and then assume that that translates to how they relate to the press corps. But behind the scenes, no one likes it. No one likes the closeness and the, you know, the unpleasant bear hug that is White House press coverage of a president. And, you know, as modern technology speeds along, every White House has new tools at its disposal to go around that press and try to speak directly to the public. I mean, I would tell you that President Obama was worse for the press than George Bush was.
How so?
So, I mean, first of all, George Bush, you know, we think of the access to Bush was incredibly regular. We had the opportunity through what are known as pool sprays, which are, you know, a small group of press brought into a foreign leader meeting or brought into the top of the cabinet meeting or what have you. So almost every day, the press corps was asking George Bush questions. And yes, it was from a small group of press, but it was still, you know, that pool is meant to be representative of the rest of the press corps. And by nature, we would always try to ask questions that were representative of what the, you know, what everybody needed to hear from the president. Obama preferred press conferences, which he did, you know, with some regularity, but not, you know, not all the time. And that was almost the only time we got to ask him questions. Was in a televised news conference. And again, using different tools, going on, you know, podcasts that didn't exist when George Bush was president, or, you know, using, there was a video feature that the Obama White House rolled out that they did every week to message to the public. And, you know, a number of other examples, like I said, where the idea was to try to go to the public directly. And that is always the idea.
But I guess one of the differences is perhaps that there was a consistency in messaging with the Obama administration. They were talking about the same numbers in the press briefings as the president was in his whatever he was doing, going directly to the public.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't need to delineate them all because we know them, but there are huge differences in the type of information and the way information has been handled by the Trump presidency. First of all, just sort of a lack of respect for information, period. And again, going back to your good point and Jennifer's good point about the rhetoric, you know, every other president has hated the press corps, but they don't talk about it the same way. And in a way that frankly is dangerous to say, because then what the public reads or listens to or hears or watches from the press, they don't trust in the same way if that language is coming from the White House.
Right. Tom Jones, we don't ordinarily think of how the press is how the public is reacting to a press briefing in the briefing room. It's usually not something that's top of news. How has the Trump relationship with the press changed the public's relationship with the press?
Well, I mean, I think it's changed greatly in terms of if particularly among his supporters, if you keep telling people these are the enemy of the people, these are fake news, eventually that message is going to seep in. And we see it at his rallies where people turn their attention to the media and boo the people like CNN and everybody else who's there is covering it. I think one of the other main things that has been an issue, and I think Jennifer Lovin can probably agree with this, I hope she would, is that we don't mind being attacked now and then. We all cover, we're used to it, mm-hmm. We're used to getting pushed back by our audiences. The people we cover are sometimes going to be angry with us. We're okay with that. We're also okay when you can't give us all the information that we're asking for. Sometimes that is something that they can't do. What we don't want is don't lie to us. And that's the issue that we've had with the Trump administration more than anything else. We went so long there with Stephanie Grisham and Sarah Sanders not giving a press conference. We all complained about why they never speak to the media. Then we get Kayleigh McEnany, and in her first time out, she said, "I promise I will not lie to you." And she has regular press conferences, and then spends most of them gaslighting the media. And I think that ultimately has an impact on the public, where they see this and they see this combative nature, and it's sort of an us versus them. We don't mind the us versus them as long as you're being truthful.
Jennifer Mashiach, do you see us going back to, I mean, as far as the trajectory of history teaches us, do we go backwards or do we go into something different?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting moment to think about the relationship between the press and the presidency, not just because of the way that Trump violated the norms, but in terms of actually what Jennifer said about how each president tries to take advantage of new communication technology to go around the press filter, right, and to speak directly to their supporters. So scholars who write about the relationship between the press and the presidency talk about the emergence of the rhetorical presidency with Woodrow Wilson. So around the time that Woodrow Wilson started to give press conferences is really a moment that shifted the relationship between the president and Congress and the president and the people. And so the president would go over the heads of Congress instead of, you know, using their communication to speak within the government, they would start to speak to the people directly and hoping that the people would accept the message and put pressure on Congress to enact the president's agenda. And so the era between Woodrow Wilson and frankly, George W. Bush is really the era of the rhetorical presidency, where you see presidents routinely doing that. And they do it in different ways. And, you know, they have different styles. But in 1980, when they named the rhetorical presidency that name, you know, they said, Jimmy Carter gives two speeches a week. You know, do we really need to hear from the guy twice a week?
Right? Those are dark times.
Exactly, right? So to think about how we've changed, you know, just access to the president and communication from the president since 1980 to now, new communication technologies with George W. Bush allowed him to go around the news filter. And his communication was almost ubiquitous. He was giving 10 speeches a day sometimes. I mean, the guy was just nonstop chatter. But a lot of it was propaganda, right? It wasn't about trying to convince the public, you know, to support the president's agenda. It was about, you know, what they call now flooding the zone or the fire hose model. You know, it was just ubiquitous communication. And Donald Trump, Barack Obama used the same kinds of direct communication strategies. And maybe the main difference between what Trump has been doing for the last 4 years and what Obama did or what George W. Bush did is that those other two presidents, you know, sought to go around the news filter, but they remained presidential, you know. So even when Obama was between two ferns, you know, doing things that other presidents hadn't done, trying to reach out to younger audiences, he was still, you know, acting like the president does. And maybe not in a way that the right wing could respect, but, you know, in a way that was still very presidential. He's a very restrained communicator.
And the same thing, though, too, for the people who speak for the president. There are presidential spokespersons who speak presidentially spokespersonally, Jennifer Lovin. I mean, I wonder if that's going to change.
Yeah, the what's going to change question is just so fascinating, isn't it? On across kind of every aspect of this transition that's about to happen, and the relationship with the press. You know, I think it's really interesting to think about how President-elect Biden and his team will they go back? Will they, you know, will they forge a new path? I mean, obviously we see in his appointments, whether it's within his communications shop or more broadly through his next administration, you know, some of the old hands, so to speak, in his political life and in the Obama world too. So, you know, they're going to bring some of that, you know, do it the old way sensibility, but they're still in the modern world and they're going, you know, and in the world as it is now, and will seek to get, again, seek to get their message out any way they can without the pesky filter of the White House press corps, which, you know, they do respect, but it'll be combative because it always is. Right. And so I think it's I just think it's really fascinating, this what's going to change question. And I'm a little call me skeptical, I guess, that it's going to be all, you know, roses and puppies.
Yeah. Tom Jones, agree. I kind of agree. Because it wasn't beforehand. And a lot of people don't know that because they weren't paying attention. Right, Tom?
Exactly. Jack Schaefer had an interesting story in Politico the other day that there is a honeymoon period whenever a new administration takes over, regardless of who that administration is and regardless of their politics. And you usually get about 100 days. And it's not that the media is hesitant to go after a president. It's just they're going to take the first 100 days to figure out where they're going to take their shot. Mm-hmm. And I think what's going to happen with the Biden administration, certainly these are much more tumultuous times than a lot of presidents have ever come into. I mean, we're talking about obviously a global pandemic, and we're at a very critical stage in that particular topic. The economy is an issue. We have race. We have obviously this divide in this country politically. So it's not an easy time for the president, but I do think there will be this moment of Trump fatigue where people are just happy, not that Biden's president, but that Trump is not president. And I think we're going to have, there will be that honeymoon period. But eventually, as Jennifer Lovin just said, we're going to get to a stage where everybody gets back to work here, including the media, and they're going to do their jobs, and they're going to hold people like Joe Biden and people in his administration accountable.
We're going to take a quick break. We are talking about the relationship between the White House press team and the White House press corps and everything in between. My guest, Jennifer Lovin, she's a former chief White House correspondent for the Associated Press. Tom Jones is a senior media writer at the Poynter Institute for Media Studies. And Jennifer Mashiach is an historian of American political rhetoric and an associate professor at Texas A&M. She's written a number of books on how presidents communicate. So if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. We're talking about President-elect Biden's communications team and the importance of who speaks for the president. Still with us is Jennifer Lovin. She covered the White House during the George W. Bush and Obama administration. She was chief White House correspondent for the Associated Press between 2008 and 2010 and president of the White House Correspondents Association between 2008 and 2009. Also, Jennifer Mashiach, she is historian of American political rhetoric and associate professor at Texas A&M University. Author of the 2020 book Demagogue for President, The Rhetorical Genius of Donald Trump, and Tom Jones, senior media writer for Poynter Institute for Media Studies. Tom, I guess in January of 2017, just right after inauguration, Poynter ran an article with the headline, "Should You Broadcast Sean Spicer's Press Conference?" And that's when it got to be a thing. And it was after his first press conference in which he repeated lies about the number of people at the inaugural events. He refused to answer reporters' questions. And the conclusion was that, yes, news organizations should broadcast the press conference because otherwise, it said, you cede the opportunity to fact check, provide context, et cetera. What do you think about that situation in retrospect now here coming up on 4 years later of this?
I mean, yeah, talking about that almost seems cute now.
Yes.
Talking about Sean Spicer 4 years ago. I dealt with this question a lot as a media writer when we got to the point where Donald Trump was speaking out on the coronavirus task force. press conferences. Yes. And the questionnaire was, should networks air those press conferences when the president is potentially giving out false and dangerous information? And at the time, I actually switched. And I think this is something, again, Trump has been so unusual for all of us that I changed my mind two or three times through the course of administration on how you cover them. Because at first I said, yes, we absolutely should show what the president is saying about everything involving coronavirus. This is very early on. We're going back, I'm talking back in April now of this year. And I felt like these are important things that the president is talking about that affects all Americans. We should show it. And then I started to come around. The pushback was, well, what if he's pushing out dangerous information? I said, well, if we edit it and we just boil it down to the important and correct things he's saying, are we then giving the public this false sort of narrative right. that he's actually handling the coronavirus very well, when in fact he might not be? And so, you know, it's almost cute now to think about Sean Spicer 4 years ago, because that seems tame compared to everything else that we've dealt right. with, not only with Trump, but with, in recent months, Kayleigh McEnany as a press secretary who's been as, you know, combative as any press secretary I can remember. Jennifer Lovin probably has more experience with that than I do. But it's my feelings about this have changed over the 4 years. And again, it's because we just don't know how to cover this guy. We still don't know how to cover
him. Right. And there'll be the 100 days, the honeymoon period, Jennifer Lovin. But and the public out there watching will question your motives then, Jennifer Lovin, right? I mean, well, if you're not telling us what he said, then why?
Correct. I mean, look, the media believes in sunlight, right? That's the sort of foundational principle that you show what's happening so people can make decisions about their leaders and decide, you know, what they think about issues, who they want to support, who they don't believe, and all of that, right? And so we've confronted, as Tom said, these, you know, incredibly unusual decisions. It used to be when the media would try to decide how or whether to cover something, it was whether it was newsworthy. I mean, George W. Bush's 800th, you know, Social Security tour was, oh my God, please shoot me now, right? And there's not a single shred of news in what he's saying, and yet he's the president, so we're supposed to write a story or something, right? Well, I mean, how cute does that seem? Right, in terms of the kinds of decisions that Tom just described, which are unprecedented, to decide whether to cover a president and to cover something he's doing or saying in its entirety because of its, you know, adherence to facts or lack thereof. I mean, that's just, it's astounding. So I kind of feel the same, like personally conflicted in a really deep way about whether, you know, you expose that to sunlight and let people see it for what it is, or you try to, in effect, censor it to, you know, not spread inaccurate information and allow the platform for that information.
Jennifer Murshia, how did the introduction of television cameras change this whole dynamic and, you know, change the questions we have to ask ourselves as journalists when we decide what to cover?
It made it performative, right? So it made it a performance space for the president. It made it a performance space for journalists. And it made it so that, you know, on the one hand, you know, information could be disseminated very quickly, immediately to, I think, 87% of households who had a television in 1960 when they start to televise the press conferences. It made television made it more of a spectator sport. And, you know, it's really interesting, I think, to think about, you know, the double bind that the media is in with Trump, because, you know, on the one hand, he will find a way to communicate directly with his supporters. He doesn't need the press. But on the other hand, he's using the press's platform to undermine the press's platform, right? And so they're sort of at a disadvantage either way.
Now, the press hasn't always been, you know, the paragon of virtue throughout history, Tom Jones, but has the Trump administration done any permanent damage, do you think?
I think that's the $64,000 question, is how has he changed the way the media covers him, the way the presidents deal with the media? Again, we're dealing with a president that who does things so abnormally And we have not been able to adjust to it. We've not been able to keep up with the social media aspect of it. It feels like the Wild West in terms of just how we're going about covering all this. And I do think he's changed things permanently. I think this, the Biden administration, it will be a key to see if things go back to so-called normal, or if we continue to see other candidates in the future try to replicate what Trump does. And that's the other thing. I don't know if Trump is just I don't mean to praise him in any way, but he's so charismatic in how he deals with people and how his supporters treat him, that I don't know if he can be duplicated, but I think we'll see people try it in the future.
Yeah. What do you think, Jennifer Lovin?
Well, look, I think we also need to, we need to speak a little truth here about the media's side of the equation. I mean, there's a lot of talk about a media addiction to Trump, and it's 100% true, right? And some of it is a legitimate and genuine outgrowth of what we were just talking about, this debate over how do you cover a guy like that, right? Like, what do you do with it? What is your ethical and professional responsibility? But some of it is economic, and let's just be really honest about that, right? Coverage of Trump has driven ratings, subscriptions, and all the rest. And I think some news organizations have adopted an agenda, even some of the most respected ones, to respond to that. And I don't think that's good for anybody. I don't think the blend, I don't want to get on my soapbox here, but I think, the digital presence of news organizations where you've got opinion and news on the same page, as opposed to physically separated like they used to be in the old days when we all read actual newspapers, is a really dangerous thing, because the public has no idea we know what a news analysis is versus an op-ed versus a news story, but how does anybody else know that?
Yeah. And I learned something in J school. It was way back when the Janet Woods scandal, the reporter for The Washington Post that made up the story about the drug addicted child. Anyway, we were told to go out and do some sort of survey, like man on the street, the torture of all of us, the man on the street survey, and ask people what they thought about journalists and journalism. And this was 100 years ago. They were very suspicious already of the press, mm-hmm. and already of the what the goals were of the press and what the mission was. Mm-hmm. So Jennifer Mershia, can you like riff on what Jennifer Lovin was saying and how that affects what you've seen over time?
Yeah. So public trust in the media is definitely down and to, tragic levels. And part of that has to do with exactly what Jennifer said. My students, I teach a class in propaganda, and my students in my propaganda class tell me all the time that they can't tell what is real information from what isn't, what is opinion from what is, reporting. They have no idea. They just can't tell at all what it is. And I think that a lot of that has to do with the way that information circulates in a disconnected way, so that, you'll see an article, but you won't even know that it came from a reputable news source.
You won't know where on the page it was. You won't know.
Yeah. You wouldn't have known what section it was. Right. And when you turn on cable news, you have reporters, sitting around a booth with opinion people. And all of that is very confusing to viewers or to readers.
And likewise, Tom Jones, what's going on during those press briefings and how that works and why people are talk the way they do and ask the questions they ask.
Exactly. And I think, as Jennifer Lovin just mentioned a minute ago, there's little separation. So you'll see, just to take as an example, Jim Acosta will be at the White House and he'll give the actual facts, the actual news that came out of the press conference. And then he'll send it back to Chris Cuomo, who now all of a sudden starts giving his opinion.
Right.
And people, as viewers, they, as Jennifer mentioned, they don't see the difference between the editorial page and the op-ed page and the news section. And often it's really become confusing of late because, as you just mentioned a moment ago, now it's on the internet. And now if you call up the New York Times homepage, you have news stories right next to opinion stories.
Right.
And viewers don't, or the audience members, they, they don't realize the difference between the two. And so a lot of times when people call me and say, well, the New York Times, they're fake news. I'm like, well, give me an example of what you're talking about. They usually point to an opinion piece.
Right.
Or the other night, I think Sean Hannity on Fox News basically admitted, like, we don't vet this stuff that we're putting out on the air. And his excuse is, I'm an opinion show. Well, people don't see it that way. And that's partly as much the media's fault that we haven't, I don't think, explained it well enough to our audiences and shown the wall between the news side and the opinion side.
I think it might have been my first guest. It might have been Annie Linsky from The Washington Post. It might have been you, Jennifer Levin. But as far as the 2016 election cycle, I was as guilty of it as anybody was, if just not when the inaccuracies, when the hyperbole, when everything was being reported as if it was true, or, well, that's just Donald Trump saying that, instead of calling out the lies for what they were over and over and over again. Most people didn't do that. Going forward, and then having to change gears once he was elected. Okay, all right, well, now we're going to call this out. I think that created a big drag on the public's belief in what the press was saying.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think, you know, some of that delayed effect that you just described, I think came out of, number one, you know, I mean, the press does get lied to all the time, right? I mean, we're given information that is incorrect. And part of your job and the reason you're supposed to have more than one source for anything is because you're supposed to go check it, right? And to figure out what's true and what isn't. And so while Trump's use of the lying tactic is, you know, beyond the pale and sort of beyond what anybody else has done, it's not like it's never something the press has encountered. And the way you dealt with it in the past was, you know, you either fact checked and you didn't include it, or you included something, you know, from somebody who gave the other side. And that was the way you dealt with this in reporting. Trump just, you know, kind of pulled the Band-Aid off all of that and did require a new approach. And different news organizations handled it differently. Do you say the word lie? Do you put it in a headline? You know, all of that, right? That took a while for those gears to sort of, you know, and old ways of doing things to get thrown aside. And so, yes, I think that delay had an impact. I don't think it was intentional. I think it was out of a sort of professional responsibility to think carefully about how we handle someone who tells, you know, untruths at such an astonishing rate. And I think the Biden team is going to have a lot of, even though it's a different administration, different team, I think there's still going to be some repair that they're going to have to do, both with the press corps and then obviously with the public, because now the public is used to an administration that, like, who knows if what they're saying is true or not. And how will the public's view of the Biden administration carry over?
And just we only have about a minute left, but I want to get your takes. You know, if you could just the idea of an all-female, ethnically diverse press team, Jennifer Mershia, it's unprecedented. Do you think it'll make any difference ultimately?
I think that we'll see and hear a lot of different things from the Biden administration than we have from the Trump administration. And I don't know that it'll be about gender. You know, I'm excited to see what their press team will do. But, you know, I think one of the main issues that will be the difference is that the Trump administration wanted to mainstream conspiracy theorists and really fringe information sources. Propaganda theorists call that narrative laundering. And I don't think we'll see that from Biden. I think we'll see much more mainstream sources of news and information getting questions.
And Tom Jones, real quick.
Yeah, I agree with Jennifer. And I think ultimately it's going to come down to how they treat the media and the information that they give out, regardless of their male or female.
Right.
It's all about their work.
And Jennifer Levin.
Yeah, I mean, I like to think that they just pick the best people for the jobs, right? And they and the value of a lot of different lived experiences and backgrounds, and the fact that there are several moms in the group, I think is important for the public. Jen Psaki's experience level is, you know, far, you know, compares to none. And I think that's a fabulous asset for the White House.
It's Jennifer Lovin, former chief White House correspondent for the Associated Press. Also, Jennifer Mashiach, historian at Texas A&M, and Tom Jones, senior media writer at the Poynter Institute for Media Studies. Thanks to all of you today. I really appreciate your time. Take care.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks to All Sides. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.